University v. Wisconsin alumni.
May it please the Court, Deanne Maynard on behalf of Washington University. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Okay.
The judgment should be reversed and the case remanded for further proceedings. For this six-year period preceding the party's tolling agreement, the claims are timely for two independent reasons. First, under the well-settled periodic payments doctrine, each underpayment was itself a breach.
And second, that only applies, though, if the breach did not go to the essence of the contract, in which case a single breach, is that right?
No, Your Honor, that's not correct.
Right?
That's not correct. Okay. And that's the error that the district court made.
Mm-hmm.
So the district court relied on a case called Siegel, which is a Wisconsin case that is not a periodic payments case. The Wisconsin court has made clear since Siegel in the Jensen case that the total breach theory does not apply to periodic payments cases, and that for all contracts where payments are due in installments periodically, as in this case, the claims are themselves, any breach of the contractual duty is itself a separate breach for each payment.
Every breach triggers a new statute of limitations.
Exactly. That's correct, Your Honor. And so at least for the period 6 years preceding the party's tolling agreement, which goes back even beyond that date for the royalties previous to that, those claims are timely under Wisconsin law dating back 100 years. And it's accepted doctrine in most jurisdictions, and this court's recognized that in the MCI case. It's very
Butler.
Settled doctrine.
It goes back to Butler.
It goes all the way back to Butler.
Whatever. Why didn't you just, in your, you're arguing, subsumed in all of your arguments, the equitable estoppel or the continuing breach theory, is the position that they had a continuing obligation to reassess the fair value of the 815 patent. Is that right?
No, Your Honor, that's a separate argument.
Is that what you're telling me? I'm wrong about everything.
No, Your Honor.
I'm not wrong about everything. So which one of those two things am I right about?
I'm going to try to answer your question, Your Honor.
Right.
There are two separate reasons why.
Sometime today you'll answer it?
Yes, sir. Hopefully
okay.
In the next 30 seconds.
Okay.
There are two separate reasons why the claims dating back 6 years before the tolling agreement are timely. One is the periodic payments doctrine. Each payment itself was a separate breach. It was an underpayment. It was too low.
Let me ask you this way. Maybe get an answer this way. According to your submission, what was their obligation arising out of that 1993 agreement? What were they obligated to do insofar as valuing the patent is concerned?
They were obligated under Section 3A3 of the agreement to set a value for the co-owned patent that was a fair value. This is what the district court held, and they
a fair value as of when?
A fair value relative, at least in 1998 when they set the value. And so, but we also believe there was an obligation under that agreement upon significant events to reassess whether the valuation
was
correct.
That's what I'm trying to get to, okay. And that obligation arises from what? What language in the contract?
That separate obligation arises directly under 3A3, which requires that the calculation of the income that Wharf is supposed to share with WashU be fair and a relative value as compared to the other licensed patents. Under
as,
their
again, view, as of when? As of 1998, as of 2001, as the, during the life of the agreement, as of when is it supposed to be fairly valued?
Definitely, initially in 1998, it had to be a fair value.
Do they have to recalculate it every year?
Not every year, Your Honor, but upon significant events that would make clear the value is wrong, you would have to recalculate it.
The Orange Book, including the Orange Book?
Well, there were significant events, yes, including the Orange Book, that's right. So including the
I got something right. That's good.
In 2000... Yeah. There's multiple significant events within the six-year period, Your Honor, that triggered a duty to reassess the valuation. One is the one you mentioned, the listing in the Orange Book. One is 2008, when Wharf internally recognizes, renews its determination that the patent, this patent, the co-owned patent, directly covers the Zemplar product. Wharf also joined Abbott in asserting this co-owned patent against eight generic companies to block competition. In four of those cases,
what year was that?
That was in 2012, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2012 and 2013, the other two solely Wharf-owned patents that directly cover Zemplar expired, and this was the only patent remaining.
Under so at that point, it became incredibly valuable.
I beg your pardon?
At that point, it became incredibly valuable.
It was incredibly valuable all along, Judge McKee.
Well, what am I surprised that you said that?
But doesn't that, if the more you talk about 1998, doesn't that make Judge Sleet's reasoning more and more accurate, even if we consider the what you call the installment payment doctrine or the periodic payment doctrine? Because at some point, if the flawed decision, whether it was flawed in good faith or it was flawed because your client was taken advantage of, if all of that happened in 1998 and there's not an automatic obligation to recalculate it each year when a periodic payment's made, does the installment payment doctrine really apply? Because isn't there some view that the 1998 decision becomes settled six years after that, because that's the reason there's a six-year statute of limitations?
No, Judge Hornick. It's quite clear under Wisconsin law that the periodic payment doctrine applies to periodic payments cases, even when
there's no duty to re-examine the calculation of that periodic payment, because that's what you just said. You said there's no standing obligation each time a payment's made to recalculate. It's only if there's a significant event, whether it's the book or something else. So, so there really is no statute of limitations.
There is a statute of limitations under the periodic payments doctrine, and it dates back 6 years from the time you sue or hear the tolling agreement. And Butler is a perfect example of that, Judge Hornick. So Butler's a Wisconsin Supreme Court case. The employee in Butler claimed that
Butler, there was a specific time at which a payment was made, and it was very clear from the very beginning what the amount of that payment was, and it was clear to the subsequent payments were less than the amount was agreed upon.
That's right, but under the question Judge Hornick asked me, Judge McKee, if Judge Hornick's theory were correct, all of those claims would have been barred because the erroneous calculation was set more than 12 years before the suit. Yet Wisconsin allowed the employee to recover the 8-year difference for the 6 years before the suit. Noonan is another example. Noonan is a Wisconsin Court of Appeals case. There, the erroneous calculation, the methodology was changed more than 15 years before the suit. It was an annuity payments case. Yet the Wisconsin Court of Appeals held that the claims were timely for the 6 years before the suit. So no, Judge Hornick, as long it does not matter even if the event makes the subsequent payments too low, even if that event occurred more than 6 years before the suit, under the periodic payment doctrine of Wisconsin, the plaintiff can recover at least for the 6 years.
I'm still with two things. One thing I just now thought of and this morning thought of. Do you know whether or not Wisconsin has a certification statute or a certification rule with Wisconsin Supreme Court?
I don't know, Judge McKee, but there's no need to certify this. The law in Wisconsin about the periodic payments case is very clear.
Well, according to them, it's not so clear because they disagree with your reading. I'm not sure they disagree with your reading of Butler. They would disagree with whether or not Butler applies in this context.
The only cases that the district court relied on, and really the only two cases that the other side has, are inapplicable. One is Siegel, which is a continuous tort case. It's not a periodic payments case. It's a case about non-compete agreement.
Let me just try to go back to the second part of the question. Get a handle on your answer to Judge Hornick's question. If I'm correct, you said that there was not an obligation to regularly reassess the value at any set time interval, only upon the end of certain events, and those events are not specified anywhere in the agreement. Is that right?
The events are not specified in the agreement, but two points about that. The agreement does not allow them to set a non-relative value. It requires them to calculate the income based on a comparison between the value of the co-owned patent and the value of the other patents, and it expressly requires them to license the patent for the mutual benefit of both parties and Under their theory, Judge McKee, all the other patents could be held enforceable and invalid, and yet they wouldn't have to revalue. Even their expert conceded that upon certain events they would have to revalue, like if someone were to challenge the event. So there's nothing in the agreement that forbids revaluation, and the agreement requires a fair relative value, which is what the district court held and they have not challenged.
But that changes over time. That's the problem here. If the fair relative value was fixed, it might still be a problem, but it would be dollars and cents. It wouldn't be the kind of money we're talking about now. The problem here is that the fair relative value changed. It changed drastically, I guess. And was it 2014 that the other patents that were supporting Zemplar expired?
In 2012 and 2013,
that's
I believe.
That's when it was a gigantic change. But you're saying even before then, there was a change in the value. The Orange Book was a change, and there's some other changes, I think, you're arguing before the Orange Book.
Well, these are merits questions that you're asking, Judge McKee. Right now, what we're claiming is that at least for the 6 years before the tolling agreement, our claims are timely for two different reasons.
The nature of the contract. There may be a merits question, but I'm trying to get to what were they obligated to do under the terms of the contract? Because in my mind, that goes to the continuing duty that you're saying they had to reassess the value of the patent.
Well, I will answer that, but I want to make clear that there are two
separate... question you will answer.
Yes, but there are two separate reasons why the 6 years are timely. One is the periodic payments doctrine applies here, and that's true regardless of whether you think they had any obligation to reassess the value. And secondly, because significant events occurred within that six-year period that we believe required them to reset the value, reassess the value, and that's enough to survive.
Is that under the principle of good faith and fair dealing or some language in the contract?
Both, Your Honor. So if I could point you to the link. First, the district court held under the good faith and fair dealing principle, and this is at A21, that Worth required to exercise its authority to assign relative values fairly and in good faith. They have not appealed that, and that is the law of this contract. In 3A3, it expressly requires Worth to apportion the income, quote, in accordance with, and I'm sort of eliding out language, but to highlight the best part, in accordance with such relative values assigned to patent rights in proportion to the total value represented by all patent rights included within such license. And so if they're going to pay it the fair value to WashU each year of the income that WashU is entitled to, upon significant events that would call into question that their low valuation of this patent was obviously incorrect.
But the logical extension of what you've told me the law of Wisconsin is on periodic and installment payments is the accuracy or legitimacy of the amount of each payment is back up on the table every year and for 6 years back from each of those payments.
Our claims as to 6 years back are timely under the periodic payments doctrine, whether you think...
The payments don't change every year. They're tethered to significant events, correct? The recalculation of the payments is not tethered, it's tethered to significant events.
In our view, Your Honor, the duty to reassess the value is tethered to significant events.
And that's from 3.83, that's where you're getting that?
From 3.83, from the combination of 3.83 and the provision in 2B2 at A295 that required Worth to license the co-owned patent to the mutual benefit of both parties. And to the extent Worth realized that it was grossly overvaluing its own patents and grossly undervaluing WashU's patents to Worth's benefit at WashU's expense, that's what we allege is a breach. And we allege that, and whether you think that's right or not, whether they're going to win on the merits is not the question. The question before the court right now is whether the claims back 6 years are timely. And they are for two separate reasons, whether you thought there was any duty to revalue or not, because the initial assessment, if that was the only assessment, then under Wisconsin law, still the claims back 6 years are timely. And as we believe, we've made a claim that they had an obligation to reassess the value of...
It's simple. It's probably not wrong here. There's such a simple drafting solution here, which is draft in a particular obligation to reassess the value of the patent at a certain date, and if upon that reassessment they determine that prior valuation was inappropriate, to make a probate adjustment for the next payment and just spell it out. And why isn't it that what you're doing, what you're asking us to do, you're asking us to put in that language in the contract and judicially amend the contract by inserting that kind of a clause?
Because the concept of the income and measuring the income and the worth of this patent as compared to the other patent already encompasses that concept. A3 does not allow Worth the power to set a non relative value. And our expert testified that in the industry, one would expect in this kind of contract to reassess the value upon the triggering of significant events. And as I said, Wharf's expert acknowledged that with respect to there were certain significance. And in fact, they did revalue. They did, upon a significant event, they rejiggered their own patents calculation in it, and apparently not the WashU one. So it's
the course of conduct. What would cause them to rejigger their own?
What they say about it is that they did it to prevent some of the owners, some of the inventors from getting double counting. But the point is, they did revalue. It wasn't set in stone. And so at this stage, we should be entitled to go back to the court and try to prove our claims on the merits. I see I'm out of time, but if I could please address our equitable estoppel claim.
I was going to ask you to do that. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Because that would, we put it forth more than enough evidence to survive summary judgment that Wharf should be a stop from asserting any statute.
What is the equitable estoppel arguments? What are the facts that would make your reliance upon them reasonable? Put it to you that way.
May I tell you the affirmative misstatements first, Judge McKee?
Sure.
Because Wharf made affirmative false statements to WashU during the period that the district court concluded was the six-year period. Starting in 1998, when they knew that WashU was trying to figure out how to assess its value as compared to the other patents in the portfolio, and it expressly WashU requested the license, the Abbott license. And Wharf replied, "We can't give it to you because of confidentiality provisions." That's a quote in the email at A171. We now know there are no such confidentiality provision in the license. Wharf expert admits that in the record at A1295-96. In 2001, also during the 6 years the district court found to be the first statute of limitations period, WashU again was trying to figure out how to assess whether its relative value was accurate, and it asked Wharf how it was calculating it. Wharf sent a letter, which is in the record at A1591-92, that contains multiple falsehoods. First, it states that Wharf attributed the compound patents, that's what the letter says, the compound patents, that they are allocated 70% of the royalties. That is not true. There is only one compound patent, and there are only two patents that were treated in the 70% category, only one of which was a compound patent, meaning that it was for a composition. The other patent was a method of treatment patent, just like the co-owned patent.
Was this information available to your client then?
No, Your Honor. Well, the letter, but not the proof that it's false.
What efforts did they take to look behind the letter? Did they make any effort at all to look behind the letter, or did they just accept these representations as true? And does that make a difference?
They accepted the representations as true, as they were entitled to under the agreement.
But was it reasonable? It may have been entitled to, but that was my reasonable question. Given the nature of the industry, was it reasonable for them to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. These are two academic institutions engaged in research, and they had worked together to co-develop a patent. WashU, under the agreement, was paying Wharf 15% administrative fee to license the patent to the mutual benefit of both parties, and there was an express obligation in the contract that Wharf cooperate with WashU. Yes, WashU should. The alternative rule is really unsavory. The alternative rule, and what they're really saying is, WashU should have believed that this other academic institution was lying to it about both the confidentiality of the license and about the way that they had calculated the royalties, and should have sued them at that point.
Could another way of saying that would be that it's incumbent on WashU to do their due diligence?
There was no way without the license to figure out what else was licensed within the license. Wharf's expert admits that.
So you're saying your client was not obligated to say prove it. When Wharf says we can't tell you because of confidentiality provision, you're saying your client had no obligation for these relationship reasons to say prove it.
That's right. But no, not just for relationship reasons, Judge Hornak, but because the agreement entitled them to rely on Wharf. WashU was paying Wharf 15% to license the patent for the mutual benefit of both parties. And that entitled Wash U as the junior party in the agreement to rely on Worf being there dealing with it.
Certainly, I read it. Assuming even that the confidentiality explanation was legit, was or it wasn't, I don't remember, assuming that it was, you certainly could have, your client certainly could have asked them to attempt to get permission from Abbott's with whatever protection they needed to have built into that protection, but allow them to get Abbott's to disclose that to you. That was, my guess is that's done all the time, where there's a confidentiality between two parties, there's a third party who's interested in the terms of that confidentiality agreement, and the third party says, look, go to your co-contractor and get their permission to disclose this to us, and we'll give whatever protections they want in terms of any further disclosure, but get them to release them. That, now, you can argue that that degree of due diligence, if you will, may not be required, may not be reasonable. In fact, you could argue that, in fact, would be unreasonable, given the nature of the institutions. But why not do that?
Three points, Your Honor, in response to that. One, this discussion we're having here is all about disputed facts. All we're seeking now is to go back and have our day in court.
I don't need to have the other.
May I please give you the answers?
Well, you guys have been on for quite a while. I don't really need, because it is an issue of summary judgment, and it doesn't matter if it's a disputed fact. I think you answered the question. Okay. Now, you can run the risk of denigrating from the answer you just gave you, which seemed to be perfectly fine, which is what lawyers usually do. They score a point, and then they take away from it by insisting on saying more. You're welcome to do that if you want, but you don't really need to.
I would beg the court for a minute of rebuttal, if I may. I know I've used way more than my time.
Well, you did have rebuttal, didn't you?
I had asked for 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Okay. So you got 1 out of your 3 minutes you can use.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rob Schaefer on behalf of Worf. May it please the court. With the court's indulgence, I'd like to start with what I think is on everyone's mind, and that is whether or not the periodic payment doctrine applies in this case. And our submission is that it does not apply for 3 reasons. First, and the court can dispose of this issue in the first instance because Judge Sleet, who not only presided over this case up until the pretrial submissions, but also over the Zemplar Hatch-Waxman litigations for more than 6 years, correctly determined that this is a total breach case when the Washington University's allegations trace back to the only time in which Worf was obligated to set a relative value to the joint patent.
I just asked Ms. Maynard about that, and she said that even if you accept that it's a total breach case, that wouldn't preclude the doctrine from applying. I may be wrong, but I think that's what you told me.
I don't think the Washington University disputes this in their brief that Segal applies. If it's a total breach case, if it's a material performance in the first instance, then the periodic payment does not apply. That's very clear. That's in Segal. I think they attempt to distinguish Segal on the facts in that it's not a non-payment performance obligation. But, Your Honor, certainly this is a total breach case.
So your theory of why Judge Sleet's correct boils down to if you got it wrong and your worthy adversary says you culpably got it wrong and your client culpably got it wrong in 1998, as long as you hold your breath for 6 years and a day, you can continue to make contractually and appropriately low payments forever.
Well, I'd like to address that because...
Answer the question first.
Yes. In the first instance, I don't think it was contractually low, but yes.
But that's a fact question.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Yes, that's correct, that the relative value was set at 0.97%. when it was originally licensed as part of a much larger portfolio of Worf's solely owned patents to Abbott in 1998. And there was good reason for that original setting of that 0.97% relative value, even though they may argue that it was unfairly low at this point.
And that's why we have trials.
And that's why we have trials. But I don't think it's in dispute. The only evidence that they can point to that's in dispute is what their experts say. And expert testimony, based on customary practice, when the terms of the interinstitutional agreement in this case are clear, and to follow up on your point, Your Honor, there is no written obligation, there's no express obligation for Worf at any point in time to revisit the relative value that it set in the first instance.
Because you're saying the obligation, the implied obligation of good faith does not require you to periodically reassess the value of the patent?
No, it's a little bit different than that, Your Honor. The implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing certainly cannot rewrite the terms that are expressed in the agreement. and we addressed that in summary judgment.
So if it turns out that your client got away with it in 1998 and they successfully held their breath for 6 years and a day,
over.
I think that's right. I don't think that's a fair characterization of the facts.
But that's what they allege.
That's what they allege.
And we haven't had a trial, so we don't know what the real facts are. We know what they say they think they can prove. If it turns out that that's what they could prove, you're going to ask for a judgment in your favor because you're going to say, yeah, that's the way the cookie crumbles.
The statute of limitations applies, and Judge Sleet correctly determined that there was a material failure, alleged material failure.
So you then get a license to make 20 more incorrect payments because they didn't do something within 6 years of 1998.
Well, I don't think that's exactly correct, Your Honor, because, again, there's no express requirement for revisitation, and there's good reason for that. And it's not hypothetical, and it's not anecdotal. They explained to the Washington University from the very first instance, and I'm at pages 1004 and 1005 of the record, in which they explained that because it was very difficult to determine whether a given patent at a given point in time was used by a licensee, that they needed flexibility in assigning the relative value.
But if you're right on the law, your answer to my question should be a bold, vigorous, affirmative, you got it, Judge. That's exactly what can happen.
That is exactly right, Your Honor. And
so is Ms. Maynard wrong when she says there was an obligation to revisit the value of these contracts given significant events?
She is wrong, Your Honor, and here's why. They were given an opportunity to negotiate the terms of this agreement. And during the negotiation and formation of the terms of this agreement, to follow up on Judge McKee's point, they did negotiate for the right to use the patent for non-commercial purposes. They negotiated the right to use it for teaching and for research. But all of the commercial purposes were granted to Worf. And at that point in time, what did they not do? They did not ask Worf for any reason, whether it be a milestone based on some threshold of royalties based on the sale of Zemplar or some significant event, whatever that is. They did not ask for Worf to write that into the terms of the agreement. There's nothing expressed in the IIA whatsoever that says the Worf has to go back and revisit, and there's good reason.
Let's assume that's true, but what about the obligation for good faith? Let me give you an example. Let's assume that you enter into an agreement, that the same two parties enter an agreement for some sort of glue. There's a chemist at the university who's working on a formula that he thinks is going to be the be-all and the end-all of glue. This is going to make super glue look like egg whites. It's going to be so strong. It's going to treat the place as welding. So they enter into this agreement, and you are asked to value this glue. And you have people that use the glue, and it doesn't work. There's a temporary, very transient, temporary bond, and two pieces of paper don't stick together. So you value it very, very low. And 6 months later, and you start making payments that are royalties based upon the fact that you lifted this glue and two pieces of paper don't stick together tightly. 6 months later, someone comes in and goes, geez, you know that glue that we found? We can put it on these little yellow things. We can call them Post-its, and you can make a fortune. So at that point, you know the value of that glue is substantial. You're saying at that point, there's no obligation to go back and say, and this is actually what happened with the glue and Post-its. There's no value and no obligation to go back and say, you know, we thought your glue wasn't worth anything because it did not create a permanent bond between two pieces of paper. But now we realize there's a very important commercial value to not having a permanent bond between two pieces of paper, and we're going to reassess your patent. You're saying they don't have to do that. They can just go ahead assuming that that patent is worthless and sell Post-its and not compensate them for it.
Your Honor, it may seem like a harsh result, but we have
a ridiculous result.
Well, Your Honor, you have to take into account that Worf was responsible to 26 other inventors who also shared in the royalties of the sale of Zemplar.
Well, what does your obligation to 26 inventors have to do with your obligations to them under your contract with them?
Well, again, there's no reason to revisit the relative value, and for good reason, because changing the relative value as to their one patent will necessarily and adversely affect the relative value as to other patents, maybe many other patents in the portfolio as a whole. We're talking about a relative value. It has to equal up to 100%. And they made this very clear to them from the get-go that they needed flexibility in assigning a relative value under 3A, little Roman numeral 3, from the very beginning. They followed up on that concept, and they said, what do? We imply a blended rate to the overall payout for each of the patents in the portfolio.
So the contractual principle is one and done.
Correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
That's what the deal of the parties was as a matter of law.
as a matter of law, and you know what? It played out exactly like that, Your Honor, because it is undisputed from 1998 until 2011, Abbott did not use the joint patent. It's undisputed that Abbott did not list the joint patent in the Orange Book until 2011. And what did Worf do? Did they skip payments? Did they miss payments? Did they say, we're not going to pay you because Abbott's not using the patent? Not at all, Your Honors. They continued to make the payments they were contractually obligated to make under the terms of the II and the 0.97% relative value that they set in 1998. And the Washington University accepted those payments and endorsed those checks.
So you made a terrific down payment on a jackpot.
That's right.
And you're saying that's, as a matter of law, that was the deal of the parties.
That was the deal of the parties. And now they're trying to come back, in hindsight being 2020, but they point to the Orange Book, they speak to all these litigation activities. Again, those were expressed within the terms of the contract. I refer Your Honors to Section 9 of the IIA, that's at A50 and 51. Washington University had absolutely no rights to do anything with respect to the litigation.
Why wouldn't that be a fact question? The meaning of the parties to the intent of the parties to the contract, why would that be summary judgment?
Well, it's a legal question that I believe that the Judge Sleet determined, Your Honor, and moreover, it's outside the limitations period. If we want to look at what's inside
that gets us equitable estoppel. And wouldn't one, the occurrence of the facts be a disputed fact as she represented them? Whether or not there was a reliance, why wouldn't that be a disputed fact? And whether or not the reliance was reasonable, why wouldn't all those things be disputes of fact?
Well, if we're talking about equitable estoppel, it's outside the limitations period. Judge Sleet correctly found, and he viewed it in light most favorable to them, there's no factual record to build here except for some expert testimony who's only going to talk about customary practice in the industry. There's no detrimental reliance.
Is it admissible evidence?
It's certainly admissible, Your Honor, but it doesn't shed any light on what happened.
So you're saying it's admissible evidence that's not very good, or it's admissible evidence that, as a matter of law, is not sufficient?
I think it's the latter, Your Honor. I think it's admissible evidence, but I don't see how it's going to help the court in determining the meets and bounds what was required under the IIA.
When they asked you to see the Abbott license, you said that was outside of the period of limitations?
The Abbott license, and I'd like to address the 1998 email, and this is at A171 in the record, Your Honor. There is absolutely, they argue in the reply brief at page 21 that they requested the license to determine whether or not the relative value was fair. That cannot be the case. First off, there's nothing in the email.
Break that down. What cannot be the case? That they did not request it, or the reasons they gave for requesting it were not right?
The reasons that they requested were not right. There's no mention at all in the email about relative value at all.
Did they request to see the license?
There was no license to request, Your Honor. The license was not executed until September of that year. This request came in May, and that's in the body of the email.
And what did they request?
They requested the license. There was nothing to give them.
Did you not respond, we can't give you the license, whether or not one exists, because of confidentiality concerns with Abbott?
Well, if I could turn your attention to what actually the email says, and my friends on the other side conveniently leave out the last sentence of the email, where Worf tells, and they responded within the hour, Your Honor, so there's no concealment here. There's no misalignment.
Simply responding within the hour does not mean concealment.
Understood.
Maybe concealed it very quickly.
Okay. Well, what they said, Your Honor, was, I would think that your office would have the same restrictions. Okay? That's not referring, with respect to confidentiality.
Say that again?
They said, quote, in the email and the response back to Washington University, in terms of the confidentiality, I would think that your office would have the same restrictions. So there was no relative value.
Did the trial judges call that a non-responsive answer?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Not by you, by your client in the email.
Well, they say that there was no license agreement because it hadn't been drafted. There was no context with respect to relative value. The relative value hadn't been set and wasn't set until 6 months later in November. So the fact that they say that they're arguing that they requested it for terms of relative value simply can't be
true. So they turn the information over in November?
The relative value is not set until November.
At that point, knowing there's a request out there, did they turn it over?
There was no request for relative value here, Your Honor. There's nothing in the email that says anything about relative value. It just says Dr. Neighbor would like to see any license or amendment that has been executed.
So were the license available?
The license was not executed until September of 1998.
And at that point, your client obviously turned it over knowing there was a request, right?
Well, they did not turn it over due to their own confidentiality practice. But moreover, Your Honor, the fact is under the 2001 letter that she cites, and that's at 854 in the record, there's no question, and Judge Sleet determined this, that there was nothing stopping the Washington University from filing suit at that point in time. They knew the relative value. They knew the number of patents in the portfolio. They knew who the licensee was to Abbott. They had received royalty checks for the past 3 years, and they could reverse calculate to determine exactly how much.
Explain that term. You both use it. What does a reverse calculate mean?
Sure. Based on the terms in the IA that are explicit, based on the revenue received, and to answer Your Honor's earlier question, the royalties were based not on some significant event, but based on the sales of the Zempar drug product. So they would take the total sales, and based on the 1993 agreement that carried over into the 1998 agreement, the royalty obligations capped at 7% to Wharf. Wharf took those revenues, and per the agreement, they took out the 15% administration fee for the prosecution. They took out one-third. That was the agreement. Those are expressed in the IIA. And they could take, based on that 0.97%, royalty relative value, which they told them about in the 2000 letter, they could divide the amount of the royalty payments that they received to come up exactly with the amount of royalty that Wharf received. And Judge Sleet correctly found that there was nothing for them to follow up, to ask a question, if it wasn't, again, for the license agreement. It certainly could be, Your Honor, for a list of the patents, because that's all they needed, and they admit that's all they needed to determine whether the relative value was fair, or the patent numbers, or they could have questioned the policies and how they came up with the 70-30 split. They didn't follow up at all. And they didn't follow up for 12 years.
So you're saying, yeah, the relative value was wrong, but they could have found that out back then, and they really didn't do the kinds of things one would expect of them to find out that we were screwing them? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, Your Honor, they were told expressly what the relative value was, and it was 0.97%. And we have to view this not as myopically as they are, but the fact that there was 31 other licensed patents that provided value to the overall Zempar product, and that was all explained to them, Your Honor.
But didn't there come a time where it became clear to someone outside of WashU that the relative value that they'd been relying upon and accepting was devalued, that was wrong?
Now, I know, Your Honor, because I respectfully...
What about when it was the only patent supporting Zempar? It's got to be huge at that point.
When it was the only, after the expiration of the compound patent,
right,
in 2014,
right.
I can see, Your Honor, the value of the patent changed, but that's the purpose, but not the relative value necessarily.
I'm getting into this Maynard's frustration. I've had a lot of problems with these 3 years.
How could the relative value not change if it's the only one out there? Are you telling me the relative value doesn't change?
Well, the relative value as to all the other patents, there were still some in existence.
But fewer.
But
so how is it relevant?
But in view, Your Honor, of the fact that the compound patent dominated all the other patents in the portfolio all the way up until 2014, that it's a blended theory that's paid out throughout all of time. And even though the patent wasn't being used, they were still getting paid on it. They say it wasn't fair, but that discounts the fact that they were getting paid on it for more than a dozen years.
That's the deal. That's not, that doesn't mean
that's the deal.
They're getting paid on it. Okay, you agree to that. The issue is whether or not there's been a time when they're being paid unfairly. So you're saying, well, look, you're getting paid on it all these years, and it was a worthless patent, so that's the big deal. So finally, it became worth some money. Okay, we didn't change the value, but we're getting money for use that maybe you shouldn't have gotten. Is that, it sounds like that's kind of what you're arguing. You're getting all this money all these years, the patent was worthless. Because of the time when it's no longer worthless, that's the deal you made.
That was the deal that was made from the very beginning, and they knew that was the deal, Your Honor. That was explained to them. That's exactly what Judge Sleet determined.
But there's a deal that if there came a time when the value of the patent changed and they somehow were fairly compensated for the patent, that's what I understand the deal to be. You're saying there's no obligation to reassess the value.
There absolutely is no obligation on behalf of Wharf to revisit, reallocate, and reset the value at any point.
Even under the doctrine of good faith and fair dealing.
That would require rewriting the contract, and that's correct, Your Honor.
But it's implicit.
It's not, because it's not expressly.
The implied doctrine of good faith is not the implied doctrine of good faith?
I refer, Your Honor, to the super value case, in that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing cannot provide an independent source of obligations from which a court may draw to reform agreements because they appear with the benefit of hindsight to be inequitable.
Okay, but the key language here is to reform the agreement.
That's
if
correct.
Going into this was basically within the realm of the expectation of both parties, You're not reforming the agreement. You're refining the agreement. You're putting gloss on what the parties to the agreement intended, and then it seems to me we're back into a push back, and that's not summary judgment.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because it does take a rewriting of the terms of the contract to require an obligation on Wharf to revisit for any reason. They say some significant event. That's unworkable. And I don't even know what that means.
Here, the Orange Book is a significant event, isn't it?
Well, it was a significant event in 1998.
Is that, you're saying it's unworkable? Is it a significant event?
Under Hatch-Waxman, yes. It's a significant event in terms of litigation.
And the other patents supporting Simplot expiring, that would seem to me to be extraordinarily significant event.
Your Honor, if I could go to your first point, because just to follow
up. Answer this question yes or no first, and then go back to the time if you want to, but answer this question.
It's not an extraordinary event in view of the way in which the agreement was originally structured.
But then we get back to the meaning of the agreement. I'm just trying to keep this simple and getting a question answered. I'm having a hell of a time doing that. If you're not trying to support Simplot expire, so the only patent supporting this drug, which is, I understand, is of incredible value in the area of kidney transplants and kidney disease. So the one patent supporting that, and all of a sudden is of no greater value than it was 3 or 4 years earlier when a lot of patents were supporting Simplot.
No, I'm willing to acknowledge that, of course, the value is greater. But the point here is that the litigation activities, and certainly the Orange Book listing, is contemplated in the original bargain for exchange between the parties.
Because it's written there, or because that's the course of dealings of the parties and the reasonable understanding of parties in their shoes?
It's written into the agreement. And it's very important to note that all commercial rights were granted to Wharf in Section 9 of the IIA, and I'm at pages 49 and 50 of the record, Your Honor. It's clear, 50 and 51, under Section 9, entitled Legal Actions, that Wharf had the sole authority to carry out legal actions, including listing of the patents in the Orange Book, which is Abbott's, and Abbott's responsibility as the
agent. You didn't have the authority to do it. There's some argument when you did it, it changed the value of the patent that you were obligated to compensate them for.
And whether it changed the overall value of the patent, I don't disagree. At some point in time, the 815 patent became more valuable. But throughout the term of this agreement, and this is rare error, Your Honor, for these types of agreements, the Washington University is doing nothing. It's sitting back and collecting royalty checks. Throughout the term of the agreement, when Wharf was responsible for prosecuting the patent, getting the patent issued.
Well, now you're back to the argument about, well, you got money you didn't deserve all these other years. Tough darts, you didn't get the money you didn't deserve.
Well, I think this was all correctly determined by Judge Sleet in the first instance.
Your argument then boils down to, and if I'm right, it's okay, you could say it, a deal's a deal.
Yes, Your Honor.
A deal's a deal, and the deal was 1998, and it was frozen in amber, and there could be significant changes, vast, tectonic shifts in the market for the drugs. It doesn't matter. Deal's a deal.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I would love to have the crystal ball that the WashU pretends to have now. I'm sorry for my informality. But this is exactly.
I started it, so go ahead.
This is exactly what Wharf was telling the Washington University from the very, very beginning, Your Honor, is we don't know how these patents are going to be used. And that's exactly how it played out. So this isn't some instance other than attorney argument in hindsight 2020 saying, hey, the value of the patent changed at some point in time. Yes, you're right, it did. But this was contemplated by the express terms in the IIA. A deal is a deal, and we've been paying you all along, whether the patent is being used or whether the patent wasn't being used.
I thought we'd gotten past this, maybe we haven't. Are you now saying that under the contract the deal was to set a value in 1998, it's X dollars, and that's what you're going to get paid for your damn patent, no matter what happens to the patent in the marketplace, no matter how valuable it may become, you're getting X dollars because you jumped into that bet in 1998 and you're not getting out of it. Is that what you're now arguing?
Almost, Your Honor. The relative value of 0.97% was set. What the amount of money that they make is based on the sales of Zemplar. But yes, they made a deal, they'd get a third of that, and the administrative fees were deducted from that. They entered into this agreement. That's exactly right. The 0.97% was negotiated for. There was no milestone payments.
At some point, that you had agreed that there was an obligation to reassess the value, and then we got into this dispute upon certain events. But I thought you had agreed that at some point it became clear that the value of the patent was much greater than had been agreed to, being compensated for that. But am I wrong about that?
You are slightly wrong. I agree with Your Honor's question that the value became more patent. I mean, the patent became more valuable. There was no requirement for Wharf to ever revisit that relative
value.
That's
what I'm trying to get to.
On any significant event. They argue significant event. They argue Orange Book listing. There is nothing within the four corners of the IIA that ever required revisitation.
Okay. At least we're getting somewhere now. You're saying the implied covenant of good faith does not extend that far because of rewriting the agreement of the parties.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
That took a while.
Okay. And I'm sorry it took a while. If I could just touch on briefly, I mentioned the one with respect to equitable estoppel. Judge Sleet properly determined the light most favorable to the Washington Year, all these. He found no concealment. He found no detrimental reliance. Certainly in 2001, he determined that they could have asked the questions, in order, the same questions they're asking now, let me see the patents to determine whether we think today it's fair.
If you're right, then what Greg Sleet found on equitable estoppel wouldn't matter because he's saying there's been no breach. So if you're right, why would he even have acquired into equitable estoppel? That makes me kind of wonder about whether or not you're saying is what Greg Sleet found.
Well, we're talking about maybe two different things, acts that happened within the limitation periods and acts that happened after. And certainly,
but you're saying it doesn't matter because the deal was you get X dollars, period.
Right.
So why get into equitable estoppel? The deal was you're going to get paid X dollars for your patent.
Right. They argued equitable estoppel that somehow we concealed something, somehow we misrepresented something. That certainly wasn't the case, and certainly nothing that they couldn't have inquired about or found out as of late of 2001 within the limit period to find out if there, or some, certainly nothing to preclude them from filing suit at that time, Your Honor. As a last point, this is not an underpayment case as my friends on the other side argue, because there's no disputed question of fact that Wharf every year and has continued every year to pay exactly what they were required to pay. Based
on the dispute there when you said we're required to pay. That's what
based on the relative value that was set in 1998 at 0.97%. They never miscalculated. They never missed a payment. They never skimmed off the top. None of those things happened. They've paid exactly what they were required to pay under the relative value that was set in 1998. The only time that they were required to set a relative value, and that was upon the original licensing of the patent. That is not in dispute. Moreover, this case is unlike the Pentuses, which in the first instance there was a required amount that was agreed to, and then there was a subsequent underpayment where each of those payments were either unrelated or independent. This all traces back to the original allegations that Wharf says deprived them of the original contract, and that is a material failure to assign a proper relative value in the first instance. That is a total breach case. The periodic payment doctrine does not apply in those cases. The Segal case makes that clear. They're not able to distinguish that case.
Okay. Mr. Schiffer, thank you. And Ms. May, you reserve 3 minutes. My hair is now on fire. What am I missing here? What the hell was this contract? Was it for X dollars per ad infinitum? Because I clearly got the feeling before today that that was not the contract at all, and that's what you're arguing.
No, Your Honor, you're right. The contract required Wharf to pay a fair relative value, which
means as of when and for how long?
Determined initially in 1998, and that determination was incorrect based on what they knew, and they hid affirmative information from us that would let us know.
And what are the facts of record that would get past summary judgment to support what you just said? That they hid information from you.
So on page A1010 in the record, there is a letter from Wharf to Abbott in 1998 saying, this patent, the co-owned patent, quote, directly covers Zemplar. Wharf knew before it set the initial valuation of less than 1% that this patent covered Zemplar. Wharf then lied to WashU in the 2001 letter where it purported to explain how it had assigned the patents. It said that it had given the compound patent set when, in fact, only one of the patents was a compound patent and the other patent was a method of use patent, just like the co-owned patent. Two, it said that it had a practice or policy of dividing 70% between the licensed patents and 30% between the ancillary patents and divide evenly between the ancillary patents. That is not true. And is a Wharf internal memo at A846-847 that explains it was one compound patent and one treatment patent. And in our expert report at 2100-01, it shows the same thing. It's also not true. There's a different distribution. They use different distributions in different cases to treat their own patents more favorably. They did not always divide
equally. So your argument is you're entitled to go to a jury and demonstrate, prove what you just argued the letter at A054 is, that your client was lied to on material matters on April 4th, 2001, when an accountant wrote them a letter, and that if you can prove that, then the door's open.
No statute of limitations can apply at all. That's correct, Judge Hornick. And secondly, we should be entitled to prove that that initial evaluation was wrong at that time. It was greatly devalued. There were only three patents in the portfolio.
Well, that's a different issue, but let me ask this. I probably need a softball to you, but if what I understand Mr. Schaefer's argument to be is correct, then we would never have any equitable estoppel inquiry at all in the district court, would we? Because it wouldn't matter, because the contract was for X dollars, that's what you got, and there's no need to get into equitable estoppel. Doesn't the very existence of the equitable estoppel inquiry suggest that at least Greg Sleet saw that the contract, at least as you were arguing, that the contract was very different than my understanding now is as to Mr. Schaefer's interpretation of the contract? Terrible question, because you don't know what my understanding of the Mr. Schaefer's view of the contract is. It's a terrible question, but hopefully you somehow guess what I was trying to ask you out of that mess.
Yes, Judge McKee, and nowhere in the contract is that say it's for X dollars. It says...
Well, I meant X dollars euphemistically. X dollars would be for the relative value, not a dollar.
It does not say that.
Okay.
So on page A96, what it says is, Wharf shall have the authority to assign relative values and to determine the income. The relative value, though, has to be the relative value between the patent rights. So to measure the fair value.
So you're saying, contrary to your friend, that when it was assigned at 0.97 in 1998, Wharf's argument is one and done, embedded in amber, that's it under the contract. You're saying, no, that's not what the language of the contract says.
Right, Your Honor. That setting at 0.9, less than 1%, that was a breach. That was a breach. And even if you think it's one and done, Judge Hornack, we definitely argue, we've argued throughout these briefs, Siegel
does not apply
here. You
concede that it's one and done. Your opponent says it's one and done. Do you concede it's one and done, or do you differ with him?
No, we have two alternative arguments, Judge Hornack. One is, even if it was one and done.
No, but my question was it one and done?
Yeah.
He says that if you read the contract, there is one valuation date, and that is 1998, and it was set at 0.97, and the contract creates no duty to revisit the 0.97 no matter what happens in market valuations of the patent over time. Is he right or wrong that that's the contract anticipated one valuation? Now, you say it was incorrect, and you were snookered later on, and all of those other things. But Mr. Schaefer says the contract says you do it one time and one time only.
It does not say that anywhere. And you can read through it and look for that. That provision is nowhere in it. It nowhere says there's only going to be one setting of the relative value. It nowhere says there's not going to be a need to reassess the relative value if it becomes clear based on significant events that the value of the Cohen patent compared
to
the
other. You're adding a term to the contract when you say it has to be reevaluated if there's significant events. What are you relying on to say that's what should happen?
I'm relying on 3A3, which says that the income that's attributed to the co-owned patent has to be a relative value as compared to the other rights licensed within the agreement. And if significant events change what is a fair relative value, and the district court held they had an obligation to set a fair relative value, if the events changed, then it must be changed.
Now, what you just said, though, if the events change, that is the gloss you're adding to your interpretation of 3.83. Is that right? Or is that written into 3.83? I don't have it in front of me.
You won't find those words in 3.83, okay. Your Honor, but the 3.83, the concept of 3.83 encompasses that, which is that the value that Wharf attributes to income for the co-owned patent has to be a fair value, that's the district held, relative to the other patents in the license. And as Your Honor speculated, if all the other patents are invalid or unenforceable, then that can't be a fair relative value. They can't count income that way.
So every time another patent drops out of the package, the relative value changes of this patent?
It certainly could. So, but whether you think, so we have two arguments that are consistent. One is they knew more in 1998 when they set the initial value. They knew 0.97 was not a fair value. The only patent that's like the other patents in the license patent is our patent. And they put it with the other 30 patents and treated it as worth nothing. But they knew and they told Abbott at 1010 in the record that it directly supports Zemplar. And under the periodic payments cases, you can't have a total breach. That's what Jensen says. Jensen to Tornik was a complete repudiation. The employer said to Jensen, we are not paying your pension payments anymore, ever. And that was more than 6 years before Jensen sued. Nevertheless, Wisconsin said, there's no total breach theory in a periodic payments case, and Jensen could recover for 6 years of his pensions from the time he sued. So even if you think and that there's only, it was one and done, the one was wrong. They set a way too low value, and at least our 6 years are timely. 6 years back are timely because two significant events happened in those 6 years. And three, they affirmatively made misstatements in the 2001 letter that aren't true. That was during the initial 6 years, and we should at least get a trial.
At least get a trial. You're arguing that there's a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not they did make misstatements, whether or not you realize whether or not the answer is reasonable. All those things you're saying are issues of fact.
Absolutely. And Judge Restrepo, if I could just say, you were saying no, Worf did not send us the license once there was a license. And although he stands here today and says, well, we should have asked, we should have tried harder to get it. Once we learned the facts in 2012 about the generic lawsuits, we acted promptly. We initiated discussions with Worf. We asked for the license. There's a repeated correspondence in the record with that. That's at A1645 to 1707. Even with a promise of confidentiality, they refused to provide the license. We had to sue to get the license. We would request that you reverse.
Maybe a transcript of this, and if you can, those attorneys check with Ms. Skrivitsky, did I say that correctly? Okay. Spend a day on that close enough. About the details of the transcript, you can split the cross. But could you also come up for a second? First of all, I would really publicly commend you, both of you. Really, really fine lawyers. I don't think either of you have been here before, at least before me, but if you come back, it's really great lawyering. So taking my advice, and again, very good job lawyering. This may not end Mr. Schaefer, thank you very much.
Thank you.